from the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up on this edition,
we're going to stay right here until we're finished, even if that means working through the weekend, which is highly likely.
That was Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell talking about putting together a relief package. What might that package look like? Well, we'll get the latest from Oklahoma Senator James Lankford. We'll also get a report on yesterday's Senate Homeland Security Committee meeting that's looking into voter fraud in the November election. And big tech under legal scrutiny again. This time, 10 states have filed a new antitrust lawsuit against Google. We'll get more from Attorney General Curtis Hill of Indiana, one of the states in the lawsuit. We'll also hear from the Arkansas Attorney General, Leslie Rutledge, on a major decision from the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals yesterday that affects the unborn. Some really good news. And speaking of life, Assistant Attorney General Eric Dryban is here on how the Office of Civil Rights is defending health care workers from being forced to perform abortions. This case is outrageous. Wait till you hear from him. And we're still here in Georgia. Yeah, we're here in the Peach State. Today we hosted a powerful pastor's briefing at the Metro City Church here in Atlanta. Dean Nelson, FRC Senior Fellow for African American Affairs, joins me with the details of that event earlier today. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Parler, it is at T. Perkins. And let me remind you once again, as we come toward the end of the year, Washington Watch is only made possible by folks like you. We receive no government money. We are on the air, almost 800 stations now, because of folks like you that want to hear the truth and want others to hear the truth. So if you'd like to partner with us to make sure this continues, we've got a group of donors that have put forth a $1 million matching challenge. So if you would like to participate, in effect, whatever you give will be doubled. So go to TonyPerkins.com. You can make your donation there. All right, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell today saying that the Senate leadership, House leadership, have met. They're close to an agreement on a coronavirus relief package, and that he's telling everybody, don't go anywhere. We're going to work this out. Joining me now to talk more about this, Oklahoma Senator James Lankford. Senator, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tony, very much.
So are we close?
That's what I hear is that we're close. It's now moved into the closed door where it is the room where it happens now. And there is a lot of dialogue going on to be able to finish it out. So it's McConnell and Pelosi and Schumer and Kevin McCarthy and the president's team all working out the very final details on it. We keep hearing that it's close, it's close, it's close. And we're waiting to be able to see the final text so we can start reading it and making sure we can see what else was negotiated.
From all the comments I've heard from the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, he was not going to allow a bloated, irresponsible bill to make its way through. Does that still seem to be the situation?
That is my hope at this point. Obviously, we're going to wait and see the final product on it, but we've got 12 bills that are the appropriation bills for the entire government that still have to be resolved. That's the normal appropriation bills that need to be done. That's has to be done by the end of the day tomorrow. And then we also have COVID relief, which we do need targeted relief, but we don't need some giant package that is spending on a lot of things that are not related to COVID. There are small businesses and not-for-profits and schools, and we've got to do vaccine distribution and testing. There's some key things that need to be in it that people really desperately need the help, but it needs to be limited to those areas where we actually need help to get it through the next couple of months, not dealing with long-term policies.
So are you confident that you'll be home for Christmas?
I am confident that I will get to celebrate Jesus' birth, and I don't know where that will be yet. But we're going to keep going until we get this resolved.
All right. I want to transition. Yesterday, there was a Senate committee, Homeland Security Committee meeting, looking into voter fraud, voter regularity issues that came up in the last election. But there was a kind of an eruption between the chairman, Ron Johnson, and the ranking member, Gary Peters of Michigan. I want to play a clip of this, and I want you to explain what took place here. Play clip number two, please.
This is not disinformation, this hearing today. This is getting information we have to take a look at to restore confidence in our election integrity. We're not going to be able to just move on without bringing up these irregularities, examining them, and providing an explanation and see where there really are problems so we can correct it moving forward.
Now, Senator, there was a heated exchange, which is not contained in there, with him and Gary Peters. Explain what transpired yesterday in the hearing.
So a couple of things. I was in the hearing the whole time, and the most heated exchange was really reaching back to a previous hearing when Senator Johnson had brought up the issue of Hunter Biden, and we were doing some background work that was not getting out into the media and some of the work with Ukraine, and Senator Peters had accused him of being a Russian plant, basically, and of just doing Russian disinformation when he was actually bringing out factual information. At the time before the election, all the Democrats were saying everything about Hunter Biden is wrong. It's all Russian disinformation. This is not true. And, of course, now that after the election has occurred, more information continues to be able to come out through traditional media saying, well, maybe there are some problems there. But they buried all of that. Well, Senator Johnson didn't bury that, was dealing with it before the election. And there's still some heat there that Senator Johnson didn't like, saying that he had been used by the Russians for disinformation when clearly Senator Johnson was the one that was in the right. Now, that's the old blood. The new issue was now Senator Schumer and Senator Peters both are accusing Senator Johnson of bringing up an issue and saying this all needs to be dropped because we need to be able to move on the election. And what Senator Johnson was saying is the American people will not move on until they get the truth. And right now they don't feel like they're getting the truth. So the best thing that we can do in a Senate hearing is not be afraid of the facts. Bring the facts out. Put them in the light, good, bad, and ugly. Let's find out. Let's see if it's misinformation. Great. Let's bring it out and show that, hey, this was a internet rumor, but it actually was proved wrong. Or if it's accurate, to be able to say what's going to happen. If we really did have dead people voting, if we really did have people voting twice, if we had people voting in two states, let's bring it all out and so people can actually see it.
Yeah, it's interesting. Last night I was at a dinner here in Atlanta with some supporters, and that was one of the issues they raised. Is why doesn't the Senate, why don't they hold more hearings on these issues that are so important to us? And I said, well, actually, they do, and there was one today. I said, but the issue is that it's buried in the media. The media does right. not want to report this.
Right. They don't want to be able to talk. They don't want to talk about it because they keep saying that this is all irrelevant. What's interesting is, and what I brought up in the hearing yesterday, is that if you go back to December of 2016, 36% of the people in the country believe that Russia had interfered in our election. You go to December this year, 46% of the people in America believe that there has been election fraud this year. But 4 years ago, the Democrats wanted to talk about everything about Russia. And we spent millions of dollars investigating Russia and then found at the end of it, no, there wasn't a single vote changed. There was no collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. The Russians were trying to do something but failed to be able to do anything. But now that it's almost a majority of the Americans believe there was election fraud this year, Democrats are saying, move along. We don't want to talk about it. We can't do that. We have to be able to get the facts out. The truth has to come to light. And if people are going to be prosecuted, they should be prosecuted.
One of the other issues brought up in the hearing yesterday was that, you know, some are saying, well, the courts didn't find anything and let's move on. Senator Rand Paul addressed that briefly in the hearing. Play clip number three.
The courts have not decided the facts. The courts never looked at the facts. The courts don't like elections, and so they stayed out of it by finding an excuse, standing or otherwise, to stay out of it. But the fraud happened. The election in many ways was stolen, and the only way it'll be fixed is by, in the future, reinforcing the laws.
You know, and I'll have to tell you, Senator, that's where about 80% of conservatives are right now in the country. They don't trust the outcome of this election. And they're saying, by golly, if we can't fix this, when we got to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the hard part is now that each state has certified their election, it makes it even harder to have any changes on that because we don't change things after an election is certified by the states. We are still the United States of America, and each state chooses how they're going to do the presidential election and to be able to send their electors and be able to send them up. And so to be able to have any of us be able to step back and say, no, that state doesn't have a right to be able to do this or that is a much harder harder issue to do because the Constitution says each state chooses their electors and sends them. And so it is a difficult process to be able to change at this point, but we're continuing to be able to shine the light and the truth out there to be able to work through. We've not stopped fighting this and to be able to get it out. Yet yesterday, one of the things that I brought up was in North Carolina, there were 130,000 votes that are there, and we broke them down in each segment of people that had died, people that voted twice, people that lived out of state but had still voted in Nevada, people that were illegally present in the United States but they voted in Nevada. That's 130,000 votes. Now, we don't know how they voted, but we do know there's 130,000 people that those votes should not have been counted regardless. So it's now, what do you do with that? In Oklahoma, if someone votes twice, they're prosecuted. What's going to happen in Nevada? We've got to be able to press to make sure this never happens again, and people are prosecuted.
Are there ways forward, knowing that the elections are state matters, they set the rules in the states, but there are parameters. Is there a way for the federal government to ensure that these laws are legitimate and they are, in fact, being enforced?
So there's a couple things we can do. One, we can incentivize it. That's a lot of what we did in 2017, 18, and 19, where we found multiple states had election systems where there was no paper ballot backup. It was electronic only. So literally, if there's going to be a recount to be able to check the voting machines, there was no way to actually check the voting machines because the voting machine was the whole voting process. We worked very hard to be able to incentivize states to be able to make that change. The vast majorities of states have made that change now, and we actually have paper ballots and use those paper ballots this year to be able to verify some of the elections and some of the hand recounts. That's helpful. So that is a shift that we did just in the last 3 years. There's much more to do to be able to help on things like absentee voting, mail voting, verifying signatures. My state requires a notary for an absentee ballot. That would have been an enormous difference in a lot of these states if they actually required some sort of verification. The states that are just mailing out ballots, like Nevada, that literally they mail ballots out to people that have not even requested them. I've talked to multiple people in Nevada that they actually receive ballots but don't live there anymore. They've moved out of state years ago, but the address where they live, they're still continuing to be able to receive ballots. That's absurd. And so just finding ways to be able to say, if your state's creating an environment where it allows for this kind of fraud, then you've got to be able to address it.
Yeah, it's critical, because without that, we cannot have confidence in our election system. And if that breaks down, I think we're in serious trouble as a nation. Senator, I want to thank you for joining us today. Thanks for leading out on these issues, and I know for certain this is something we're going to be talking about in the weeks, months ahead as we move into not only the midterm elections, but looking forward already to the 2024 election.
Yeah, we as we do as Americans, that is the joy that we have in a free system, is to be able to help guard that republic and then to be able to stay engaged and to make a difference. So thanks, Tony, for what you're doing.
All right. And, Senator, if I don't talk to you before, have a very Merry Christmas.
Thanks. Merry Christmas to you and your family as well.
All right. Folks, this is important, you know, as we move forward, that we are exposing what happened. In fact, this is something to be praying about. Pray that all of this stuff that was done behind the scenes, behind closed doors, it's exposed. Now, whether or not it affects the outcome of the November election, I don't know. But we need to make sure that we address all of these issues going forward. It's extremely, extremely important. All right. Don't go away. We've got a lot more Washington Watch to come. 10 states have filed a new antitrust lawsuit against Google. We'll talk to the Attorney General of Indiana, Curtis Hill, next on Washington Watch.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Hannah.
What's going on? Why so gloomy?
Well, I'm a little disappointed. I had a lot planned to do during the stay-at-home time, and I just didn't do it.
Oh yeah? What did you have planned that you didn't get to do?
Well, I was actually hoping I'd finally be able to get time to do a regular Bible reading routine, and I started a couple of times. I just didn't stick with it.
Don't be too down on yourself. Starting a new routine can be hard, but one way to help is to join in with others and to have a good game plan. I think I have a good solution for you.
Oh yeah?
Tony Perkins and FRC are doing a 2-year study in the Word. They have it all mapped out.
When did they start? I would be so far behind.
Oh, that's not a problem. You can literally jump in anytime. There's a daily reading, just a couple of chapters a day, with questions to help you think about what you're reading.
Nice. Where can I find this?
Go to frc.org/Bible, and you can get started.
Where's that again?
frc.org/Bible.
Got it. Checking it out now.
In a recent poll, it was revealed that only 6% of Americans hold a biblical worldview. This research also indicated that Christianity's teachings on abortion, marriage, and homosexuality are not only misunderstood, but seen as dangerous and subversive. In response to this trend, Family Research Council has released a new set of resources in our Biblical Worldview series. In addition to our full publications, which cover the topics of Christian political engagement, abortion, religious liberty, and human sexuality, FRC now offers helpful summaries of each publication in this series, as well as accompanying prayer guides to help you and your family pray through these important issues. And finally, our popular Biblical Principles for Political Engagement is now available in Spanish. All these resources are free and available at frc.org/worldview. Again, that's frc.org/worldview.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold. To Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So good to have you with us. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Parler, it is at T Perkins. All right, big tech under legal scrutiny again. This time, 10 states filing a new antitrust lawsuit against Google. Joining me now is one of the attorney generals that is a part of this, Curtis Hill. He's the attorney general for the state of Indiana. General, welcome to Washington Watch.
Tony, thank you for having me on.
Well, a lot of people interested in this because a lot of eyes on big tech these days with what they've been doing with great intensity just in recent days. But this is something, when you look at these antitrust suits, this is something that's been going on for some time. And been under the watchful eye of many attorney generals like yourself. Explain to our listeners what this is all about.
Well, we've been conducting this particular investigation for well over a year, and let's be straight. We are not anti-business. In fact, the AGs that are on this particular lawsuit are very pro-business, and we want to promote business and good practices. This is about particular misconduct. This is about using bad practices to stifle competition and inappropriately hoard the market. And we've seen examples of this being done by these big companies. And the danger is once they control the market, then there's all sorts of mischief that can be applied. And we're seeing lots of those things in terms of managing and controlling content and really breaking away from free speech interests that the Internet is designed to promote.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that, General, because, you know, I was thinking about that as I was reading some of the articles here. You know, the Republicans, for the most part, are seen as pro-business, and they are free business, free markets.
Mm-hmm.
We want to see people prosper. We want to see people have opportunities. But there comes a time where there appears to be some underhanded activity here to try to keep other people from having opportunity to succeed. And that is apparently what you're looking at, if I'm not mistaken.
That's exactly what's happening. There's lots of tech companies in this space that are absolutely prohibited from entering because they're not playing by Google's rules. So Google has the control of the display advertising. Basically, they control the seller's market, the buyer's market, and the auction house in which these exchanges take place. So they have the absolute control over that mechanism. And when you have that kind of control, you can dictate who gets to enter the market and who doesn't. And through that process, they've even made arrangements with Facebook, another giant in this space that is being scrutinized, to allow Facebook to have certain access that other companies don't. So it's really becoming problematic for the small tech innovators, and that's what we're really trying to protect. That innovation in technology, that comes from competition. And if we don't have that competition, we don't have the innovation, and we start to get very lazy in our technical advances.
General Hill, when you look at this from a standpoint of obviously we want people to have opportunities, but when you start to have monopolies and antitrust situations such as this, what's the bottom line for the consumer? How is the consumer affected by this?
The consumer is going to pay more money because once you have a large group like Google that's able to control the market in such a fashion, there's going to be less choices for the consumer. There's going to be higher prices paid by the consumer. There's going to be content shifting for the consumer. So the consumer is not even going to have access to all of the information that is available out there. You know, the internet was supposed to be an opportunity for everybody to participate, everybody to get access to information. And Tony, if you think back a few years ago, you could Google something, as they say, and you would get all sorts of information at your fingertips. You do that today, and much, if not all, of that information has already been filtered by Google, and you're only getting what they'll let you get. And that's not what the consumer bargained for.
And this type of action by states against a massive company like this, this is not new. I mean, we've seen this. This is action that's been taken before, has it not?
Well, this is an offshoot. We actually have another action with several AGs and the DOJ that's addressing Google's monopolistic practices on the search side of things. This action is about the display ads, and there's a subtle difference, but it's a similar situation. They're controlling aspects of these of the access to advertising, and in doing so, ultimately impact the end user consumer.
But historically, we've seen antitrust actions taking place. I mean, consider Ma Bell, the phone company, and what has come forth from that. You remember when you can only make long distance calls on Sundays?
Absolutely.
Because there just wasn't the competition, but when the government stepped in and said, hey, wait, this is a monopoly. You got to divest yourself of some of this. Look what happened with the competition and how readily available phones are now.
And we have to be careful in the antitrust space because we do want to promote and incentivize businesses, all businesses. And so there are line drawings that we have to be careful with. We don't want to punish solid building of a monopoly. I mean, the fact that a company using proper practices grows into a monopoly in and of itself is not a bad thing. It's when they grow into a monopoly using artificial means and anti-competitive factors that are beyond the pale. And so we always have to make sure that we recognize that a business that's doing well, that's growing well, that's successful on its own merits, we want to applaud that. And that particular aspect should be driving competition as well. So we want to strike that balance, making sure that we go after companies that are displaying inappropriate practices versus companies that are building their market share in a legitimate manner.
So it's when you start throwing a few elbows under the hoop that
that's
you get a foul.
That's it.
All right. General Curtis Hill, thanks so much for joining us today. As always, great to talk with you.
Thank you, Tony. Appreciate it.
All right. Attorney General Curtis Hill of Indiana. I tell you, more and more is being seen about these big tech actors, and they're throwing more than elbows. All right. When we come back, we're going to talk to another attorney general, Leslie Rutledge from Arkansas. Some good news yesterday out of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. that affects the unborn. That's next here on Washington Watch. Don't go away.
Since the 1973 Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision, Congress and many states have taken various actions to stop taxpayer dollars from funding abortions or the abortion industry. As early as 1976, Congressman Henry Hyde led the effort to ban federal funding for abortions. The Federal Hyde Amendment, named after him, established the principle that abortion is not health care, and therefore taxpayers should not be forced to fund abortions. Despite these efforts, the abortion industry still receives millions of dollars each year in taxpayer money. In 2019, Planned Parenthood, America's largest abortion provider, received $616.8 million in government funds. Family Research Council's newly updated pro-life map tracks how your state has taken action to stop taxpayer funding of abortions. Go to frc.org/pro-life maps to see where your state stands in the fight for life. That's frc.org/pro-life maps.
Aw, man.
What's wrong?
I just missed Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, and our congressman was going to be on the show today.
Oh, that's not a big deal.
What do you mean?
Well, you can always catch the replay of the day's show.
How's that?
With the Stand Firm app.
Yeah?
Yep, you can catch that day's program and so much more. You can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes while conveniently going about your day. You can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on the main feed so you can stay up to date on local and national news.
Wow, I definitely use that. How do you find the app?
Just visit frc.org/app and download, or search Stand Firm in the App Store.
Okay, that's Stand Firm.
Yep, Stand Firm.
How do you know all this?
Because I'm a SageCon, but that's another story.
Huh?
This is Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So good to have you with us. The website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, we just heard from the Attorney General of Indiana, General Curtis Hill, one of the 10 states that is part of the antitrust lawsuit against Google. My next guest is a part of that suit as well, but that's not why she is joining us today. Americans United for Life has ranked Arkansas, the state of Arkansas, as the number one pro-life state in America. Now, I'll just have to say, I guess Louisiana had to give them another state an opportunity. I'm biased, okay. But some really good news. Good things happening there in Arkansas. I have to say I'm proud of them. And they got a green light yesterday by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals that has lifted a previous ruling that blocked four, count them, four Arkansas pro-life laws going all the way back to 2017. But now the laws could very well be in effect by Christmas. What are those four acts? Well, joining me to talk about this is the Arkansas Attorney General, General Leslie Rutledge. General, welcome to the program.
Oh, good. How are you, Tony? Always good to speak to you. And yes, I had to give your good Attorney General, Jeff Landry, a run for his money and make Arkansas the most pro-life state in the union. Louisiana is blessed to have a great AG, but I had to make sure I keep losing to you all in football, and I had to send him bacon from Arkansas. So I had to win against you guys. But I think we all need to shoot to be number one and be in the most pro-life state.
I'm all about competition. And so I'm grateful that there are states competing to be the most pro-life states. And I'll have to say, when I look at these laws you've passed, you guys deserve that ranking. Explain those laws that you successfully got the Eighth Circuit to give a green light to yesterday.
Well, this has to do with discriminatory sex selection abortions and dismemberment. You know, these are huge wins. We had a big win yesterday from the Eighth Circuit, but we know that the defendants will try to appeal again and send it back to the trial judge. But we're going to keep fighting. We have won four out of five cases that have gone to court. We're waiting on another case to come down from the Eighth Circuit. And this is important for all of these, you know, children, all the moms, all the people, our Kingsmans. And so these are just huge wins.
So these, based on the Eighth Circuit, the stay is removed. So these laws can actually go into effect. Is that right?
Well, there's a 7 or so day period that we're waiting on. So I guess now 6 days that it'll have to hold until we see what the defendants are going to do, what they're going to ask the courts. But ultimately, yes, that is the, you know, that once these laws go into effect, and, you know, these children will be saved from sex discrimination by abortion and the barbaric practice of dismemberment.
Right, right. And, of course, one of them also requires doctors to notify law enforcement when anyone 16 or younger obtains an abortion. So, I mean, that's a great protection against these young people being traumatized by abortion. Also regulates the burial of the remains of aborted babies, again, addressing the humanity of the unborn. So, I mean, I commend you, and I know you've aggressively defended these laws on behalf of the citizens of Arkansas, so I thank you for that as well. And you know, despite all of the kind of some of the unsettling news that we hear, there are a lot of good things happening, especially on the pro-life front.
Indeed, and that's what, you know, when we are looking at cases across the country, I mean, we were very disappointed in the Supreme Court not agreeing with the case out of Louisiana that had been argued, that Liz Murrell, the Solicitor General of Louisiana, had argued earlier in the year. Arkansas was very supportive of that, but more and more Americans are recognizing that when life begins, and science is catching up with it, life begins at conception. Yeah. And Tony, and you and I probably agree that, you know, God knew us before we were in the womb.
Right.
And that, you know, but however, we have to make sure that more and more Americans have access to that science and that we bring these cases to the courts. So that way, hopefully now with a more conservative U.S. Supreme Court, that we will see some of these cases and some of these barbaric practices being overturned, and, you know, for the child and for the safety of the mother.
Right. But it's a process. And as a former legislator who actually the bill that Louisiana argued before the Supreme Court, the original version I did back when I was a legislator on the Clinic Regulation Act. But passing the law, I found, is just a small part of the process. To get it implemented, you have to have committed attorney generals in these states that are willing to defend and fight for these laws, and it sometimes takes a long, long time. So I commend you, Leslie, for being in that fight and working with the legislature there in Arkansas to ensure that these laws do, in fact, go into effect.
Well, absolutely. And like I said, you know, we've got a great partner there in Louisiana. We've also got incredible attorneys general all across the region in Mississippi, and Curtis Hill in Indiana that you just spoke with about the Google lawsuit. So it takes all of us, not just passing the laws like our legislators and signing them as governors, but fighting for them in court wholeheartedly to protect the life of the unborn.
And the good news is I think we are winning on the life front. So let's keep going. Attorney General Leslie Rutledge, thanks so much for joining us today, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, Tony. Have a great day.
All right, you too. All right, coming up next, still here in Georgia for a number of events. We had a pastor's conference today. And when we come back from the break, Dean Nelson, FRC Senior Fellow for African American Affairs, was on the ground with us today for that pastor's briefing. Great event. He joins me. Don't go away. We're back after that. Hello, this is Tony Perkins. With the balance of power in the U.S. Senate on the line, the runoff elections for Georgia's two U.S. Senate seats on January the 5th may be the most important Senate elections of our lifetimes. The outcome will have a profound impact on the future of faith, family, and freedom for all Americans. That's why we're inviting you to join us in North Georgia for our Pray Vote Stand Georgia Rally Tuesday, December the 15th at 7 p.m., Join me, Congressman Doug Collins, Congressman Jody Heise, Congressman Louie Gohmert, Todd Starnes, Abraham Hamilton, and others, as we join together to discuss how we can get involved. The rally will be at Truett McConnell University in Cleveland, and again, it starts at 7 p.m. For more details, visit PrayVoteStand.org. That's PrayVoteStand.org. This rally is sponsored by FRC Action and AFA Action.
Are you looking to grow closer in your relationship with Jesus Christ and in your knowledge of God's Word? Family Research Council has a three-part series titled, Three Ways to Read the Bible. This series shares helpful ways to be encouraged and directed by God's truth by observing the text of the Bible and applying it to your life. There is no better time than now to get to know God through His Word by looking into the Bible to see what it says about itself, God, and humanity. There's no better time than now to begin devoting time to the Lord and to seek out His meaning for you. This blog series is a great primer on opening your eyes and heart to Him through the Bible amid the toils and troubles of today. Check out this helpful resource and learn how to read the Bible with not just your eyes, but with your heart and mind as well. To learn more, visit frcblog.com/ways to read. That's frcblog.com/ways to read.
The rapidly changing moral landscape of the 21st century presents a challenge for Christians committed to biblical sexual ethics. An uprising against morality has overturned centuries of norms concerning the family, marriage, and human sexuality. Secular culture is not the only challenger of Christian sexual ethics. Increasingly, theologically liberal churches and denominations are rejecting the church's historic teaching on marriage. As a result, Christians are facing increasing pressure to compromise the Bible's teaching on human sexuality. How should Christians who are committed to God's Word respond to these challenges? What does the Bible teach about sexuality? Family Research Council has a new publication that presents the biblical principles for human sexuality. It lays out a survey of culture, scripture, and church history that will help pastors and all Christians meet modern-day challenges to biblical sexuality with truth and love. To access this publication, visit frc.org/human sexuality.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas everywhere you go. Take a look in the 5 and 10.
All right, Merry Christmas from Georgia. Yes, we're still in Georgia. Today, had a pastor's briefing. We're going to talk in a moment with Dean Nelson, who was a part of the program, along with myself and others. But first, some breaking news out of the Department of Justice. We had the opportunity here in the last minute to bring in our good friend, Eric Dryban, Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division at the Department of Justice yesterday. They were a part of filing a lawsuit in Vermont to protect health care workers from being forced to perform abortions. Eric, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, thank you for having me back. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can I just say, you guys never stop, and I'm so encouraged by that. You keep defending the rights of people to go to church, of health care workers not to have to violate their faith and be forced to perform abortions. I mean, I've been involved in government for like 25 years. This is so refreshing and encouraging to see that you guys just will not let up on upholding these basic civil rights.
Well, thank you, Tony. These are important to us as well as to President and Attorney General Barr, and we will continue as fighting for the right to religious freedom as long as we can, and it's critically important to our country and to the people involved.
All right. Give our listeners the details of this particular case in Vermont.
Yeah, so there's a nurse who worked at a health or medical center, the University of Vermont Medical Center in Vermont. She, for religious reasons, was and is opposed to participating in abortions. She expressed that point of view to the University of Vermont Medical Center and the staff there. They all knew it. They knew she did not want to participate. And yet the medical center, we allege and are prepared to prove, that they deliberately scheduled her to assist with an elective abortion at the same time while they misled her to believe that the procedure did not involve abortion. So she ends up shows up thinking she's helping with a procedure unrelated to abortion. She gets in the surgical room, and she's told she better perform or help assist the abortion, and if not, her job is in jeopardy. And I think she then filed a complaint with the United States Department of Health and Human Services. Their Office of Civil Rights investigated the case, and they concluded this was a violation of a law called the Church Amendment, and then they referred the case over to us, and yesterday we filed a lawsuit on her behalf, and not just her, anyone else at the University of Vermont Medical Center who is being treated this way.
Now, let me make sure I get this straight, Eric. So they knew that this nurse had a moral issue with abortion, and so they intentionally structured it so she would be forced to be in the room where the procedure was being conducted and would have to be a party to it and told she had to do it. So this wasn't like it just happened. She happened to be the only nurse there and this came about. And so, you know, she had to render, services to aid with this. This wasn't done intentionally. This is egregious.
This was, let me clarify. We only are making allegations. But we are prepared to prove these exact allegations in a federal court in Vermont, and we have filed our complaint yesterday. Yes, we are alleging that this was an intentional, deceptive endeavor to force this individual to violate her religious objection to participating in abortions. And I think, Tony, that kind of dishonesty, as well as that kind of lack of respect for her religion and her religious faith, goes against everything this country stands for. At a minimum, no one in this country should ever be forced to participate in an abortion when it violates their religion or their moral objections. And in fact, more than that, doing so violates federal law.
Yeah, that's outrageous. Now, Eric, I know, you know, you're an attorney. You're very precise at what you do. But is this something that you think happens more? I mean, is this just a one-off? This is a rare occasion? Or do you think that there are workers out there, nurses, healthcare workers out there, that live under this type of burden that they might be forced to do this because they're in a hostile environment?
Well, it does happen, and in fact, at the University of Vermont, we are alleging that this is part of an overall pattern by the defendant in that case to do it not just to this individual on one occasion, but to do it over and over and over. How much other institutions are doing it is not entirely clear to me. I'm sure, you know, we live in a country of 300 million people or more, and I'm sure it's happening elsewhere. And one of the things that we're hoping is that by bringing this lawsuit and pointing out the federal law protections that are in place for people of faith or people who have moral objections to participating in abortion, that others will come forward to the Department of Health and Human Services or the Department of Justice if this is happening to them so that we can put a stop to this to the extent it's happening elsewhere.
Wow. Well, once again, Eric Drabant, I salute you and your team there at the Department of Justice just doing outstanding work. Thanks so much for doing it, and thanks for stopping by today and filling us in on it.
Well, thank you, Tony, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you as well.
All right.
Eric Drabant over the Department of Justice. And, I don't need to say this, but, I mean, what a stark contrast between what we're looking at with a potential Biden administration. Remember these days, folks, where we've had an administration that has people like Eric and others. Yesterday we had the Secretary of Health and Human Services on. These are folks that are deeply committed to upholding the founding ideals and principles of America, and they've been doing it. And look, we're post-election, and they're still doing it. Talk about commitment. I'm telling you, you're going to look back on this, you say, we got to make sure we correct what happened in November. All right, speaking of that, there's still an election going on. As I mentioned earlier, we're still in the state of Georgia, where the state of Georgia is still in the state of election. It never stopped here. They rolled right into the runoff election. FRC Action has been hard at work here in the Peach State. And this is going to be a historic election. We talked about this yesterday. You can't point at any time in history where two Senate seats from one state were on the ballot the same day, which determined the balance of the United States Senate, which will determine if one party controls the entire federal government for the most part. Well, today, FRC Action hosted a pastor's briefing to equip the leaders of churches, pastors, and others to know what is at stake in this election and what they need to do to speak out and to really expose some of these candidates, like one of the Senate candidates here, Raphael Warnock, what he has said over the last week, last few weeks, and how that's inconsistent with Scripture, even though he's a pastor. Well, joining me now to talk about this is Dean Nelson, FRC Senior Fellow for African American Affairs and the Executive Director of Human Coalition Action. Dean, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Great to be back, Tony. Thanks so much.
Hey, give our listeners a kind of a quick overview of today's pastor's briefing.
Well, fantastic briefing. Thanks so much for your leadership in putting it together. We had some fantastic leaders on the ground. We were pleased to host it at Metro City Church. Bishop Flynn Johnson, who is not familiar with FRC, but once hearing about what we do and our work, you know, basically raised his hand and said, can we host it here? And because of his church being in Atlanta, it had a particular draw to, I'd say, a good number of African-American pastors and leaders who came out. So it was a fantastic day, emphasizing the biblical values that we all talk about here at FRC, and particularly talking about Reverend Warnock, who is a minister of the gospel, and some of those pastors that were there from Atlanta signed on to a letter challenging him on his pro-abortion stand. So it was a great event with some fantastic leaders, and I believe that it's going to make a huge impact in this election coming up.
You mentioned the Reverend Raphael Warnock and his statements or his positions on abortion in the recent debate with Senator Kelly Loeffler. He made reference to his view on abortion. In fact, we have that clip, so, you know, it's not us giving commentary. I want folks to hear exactly what he said. Bobby, play clip number six, please.
I have a profound reverence for life and an abiding respect for choice. The question is, whose decision is it? And I happen to think that a patient's room is too small a place for a woman, her doctor, and the U.S. government.
How are the pastors, African-American pastors here in Georgia, responding to that?
Well, I will say first, Tony, many of them that he has known are not even responding to that. All they can see is a black preacher who is a Democrat, and they want to get behind him. However, there is a growing number of black preachers that have said, wait a minute, we just heard him say that he is not just a pro-choice candidate. In an earlier tweet, he said that he would support abortion rights strongly. And so many of them are scratching their head and saying, hey, look, it's okay to have, you know, politicians that might say that, but somebody who is a preacher of the gospel, and I think that it rings hollow for some black pastors or any pastor when they hear that because of two reasons, and I've challenged this publicly. Number one, in the Georgia State Legislature, there is a black pastor who has been involved with FRC by the name of Mac Jackson, who also serves. He's a Democrat, but he voted in support of pro-life measures like the one that passed and that Brian Kemp signed last year, which was referred to as a heartbeat bill. He has other examples in Congress, like Floyd Flake, who served some years ago, was a minister of the gospel, who was a Democrat, but who was a pro-life advocate. So Reverend Warnock can't have it both ways. You can't say you have a profound respect for life and yet not vote that way, particularly as a minister of the gospel.
Now, another issue that came up today, and by the way, this pastor's briefing we did at the Metro City Church was predominantly African-American pastors, which was quite encouraging. And I know you've been doing a lot of work in that, but there is something happening. I've seen it over the last few years, but it's intensifying where these lines of division that have been based upon ethnic background are coming down. And as we talked about today, those that believe in the Word of God are coming together based upon that firm, solid foundation. But another issue that came up that was brought up today by the pastors is the issue of this LGBTQ agenda that has been attached to the civil rights movement. I want to play a brief clip of something that the Reverend Warnock has said also about that. Play clip number 7.
Know that as I make my way to the United States Senate, you have someone who will stand up for the Equality Act.
How is that going over?
Well, first, so I'm sorry to say that so many people don't really understand what the Equality Act is. I mean, Tony, you've learned this, and I learned this. When you come to D.C. And you have something unpopular, Democrats will put a nice name to it to confuse people. But the more that we tell people what the Equality Act is, they're like, wait a minute, we don't stand for that at all. And I think that it was most profound today to have the niece of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Alveda King, who brought that up as an important issue, because Raphael Warnock is in the same pulpit, not technically, but in the same church. It's a newer facility that that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke at. And so I think the more that we get the word out, the more people are shocked about his position on supporting LGBTQ rights, almost to the exclusion of saying, look, this is more important than African-American rights. And you're absolutely right. The civil rights movement was a moral movement that came out of the church, and they have hijacked it to a large degree for their own agenda.
There was also discussion brought up by the pastors about the Democratic Party platform and how and if it can be influenced to allow greater space for those who believe that life is sacred, those that believe in natural marriage. And there seems to be a growing awareness that the party is not open to those differing views.
Most definitely not at the federal level. I mean, you and I have worked with pro-life Democrats in state legislatures and places like that. But at the federal level, it almost is non-existent. And, you know, I applaud, and I do know good men and women who are still registered as Democrats who are trying to have their voice be heard, but they're silenced. And I don't see that they're going to have any real traction anytime soon. And so my encouragement to people is, listen, regardless of your party affiliation, stand on the word of God and vote your values. Fight for what you believe in, because at the end of the day, if we don't protect these fundamental rights like religious liberty and fight for preborn children, ultimately a Biden-led White House, as well as a Kamala Harris presiding over the Senate, is going to be detrimental to faith and values.
Yeah, absolutely. Dean Nelson, thanks so much for joining us today, and thank you for being on the ground here in Georgia and working with pastors, and you do a great job, and you're winning hearts and minds. We appreciate you being on the team.
Amen. Thanks so much, Tony.
All right. Dean Nelson, senior fellow here at the Family Research Council for African American Affairs and the executive director of Human Coalition Action. And there's resources available for you, folks. If you live in the state of Georgia, you can go to prayvotestand.org. There is a voter guide. Shows you where the candidates stand on the issue. And for everybody else, you can go there, too, because you need to pray. Pray that the people in the Peach State get it right. All right, until next time, I'll leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, you've done everything you can do. You've prayed, prepared, and taken your stand. By all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.